after him inquiringly, but made no comment. He needed to put himself to the test, discover an answer that would restore his ability to survive. With a grimace, he resolved to go hungry until he found what he required. Perhaps in hunger he would become lucid enough to solve the fundamental contradiction of his dilemma. All the abandoned weapons had been cleared from the glade, gathered into a pile. He went to it and searched until he found Atiyaran's stone knife. Then, on an obscure impulse, he walked over to the horses to see if Dura had been injured. When he learned that she was unscathed, he felt a vague relief. He did not want, under any circumstances, to be forced to ride a Ranahin. A short time later, the warriors finished their meal. Wearily, they moved to take up the quest again. As Covenant mounted Dura, he heard the blood guard whistle sharply for the Ranahin. The call seemed to hang in the air for a moment. Then, from various directions around the glade, the great horses came galloping, manes and tails flaring as if afire, hooves pounding in long, mighty, trip-rhythmed strides. 9 star-browed chargers as swift and elemental as the life pulse of the land. Covenant could hear in their bold nickering the excitement of going home, toward the plains of Ra. But the questers who left dead Soaring Woodhelven that morning had little of the bold or home-going in their attitudes. Quan's yeoman was now 6 warriors short, and the survivors were gaunt with weariness and battle. They seemed to carry their shadows in their faces as they rode north toward the Middle River. The riderless horses they took with them to provide relief for the weaker mounts. Among them, Saltheart Foamfollower trudged as if he were carrying the weight of all the dead. In the crook of one arm he cradled Pieton, who had fallen asleep as soon as the sun cleared the eastern horizon. Laura rode behind Lord Morim, gripping the sides of his robe. She appeared bent and frail behind his grim set face and erect posture, but he shared with her an eroded expression, an air of inarticulate grief. Ahead of them moved Prothol, and his shoulders bespoke the same kind of inflexible will which Atiyaran had used to make Covenant walk from Middle Stone Down to the Soul's Ease River. Vaguely, Covenant wondered how much farther he would have to follow other people's choices. But he let the thought go and looked at the Bloodguard. They were the only members of the company who did not appear damaged by the battle. Their short robes hung in tatters. They were as filthy as anyone. One of their number had been killed and several were injured. They had defended the lords, especially Varial and Tamarantha, to the utmost. But the Bloodguard were unworn and undaunted, free of rue. Banner rode his prancing, reinless Ranahin beside Covenant and gazed about him with an impervious eye. The horses of the company could manage only a slow, stumbling walk, but even that frail pace brought the riders to the ford of the Middle before noon. Leaving their mounts to drink or graze, all of them except the Bloodguard plunged into the stream. Scrubbing at themselves with fine sand from the river bottom, they washed the blood and grit and pain of death and long night into the wide current of the Middle. Clear skin and eyes reappeared from under the smears of battle. Minor, unhurt-loamed wounds opened and bled clean. Scraps of shredded clothing floated out of reach. Among them, Covenant beat his robe clean, rubbed and scratched stains from his flesh as if he were trying to rid himself of the effects of killing. And he drank quantities of water in an effort to appease the aching hollowness of his hunger. Then when the warriors were done, they went to their horses to get new clothing from their saddlebags. After they had dressed and regained command of their weapons, they posted themselves as sentries while First Mark Tuvor and the Bloodguard bathed. The Bloodguard managed to enter and leave the river without splashing, and they washed noiselessly. In a few moments they were dressed in new robes and mounted on the Ranahin. The Ranahin had refreshed themselves by crossing into Andalane and rolling on the grass while their riders bathed. Now the company was ready to travel. High Lord Prothol gave the signal, and the company rode away eastward along the south bank of the river. The rest of the day was easy for the riders and their mounts. There was soft grass underhoof, clean water at one side, a tang of vitality in the air, and a nearby view of Andalane itself, which seemed to pulse with robust sap. The people of the land drew healing from the ambience of the hills, but the day was hard for Covenant. He was hungry, and the vital presence of Andalane only made him hungrier. He kept his gaze away from it as best he could, refusing the sight as he had refused food. His gaunt face was set in stern lines, and his eyes were hollow with determination. He followed a double path. His flesh rode Dura doggedly, keeping his position in the company. But in his mind, he wandered in chasms, and their dark, empty inanition hurt him. "I will not." He wanted to survive. "I am not." From time to time, Aliantha lay directly in his path like a personal appeal from the land, but he did not succumb. "Covenant," he thought. "Thomas Covenant. Unbeliever. Leper, outcast, unclean." When a pang from his hunger made him waver, he remembered Drool's bloody grip on his ring, and his resolve steadied. From time to time, Laura looked at him with the death of Soaring Woodhelvin in her eyes, but he only clenched himself harder and rode on. "I won't do any more killing." He had to have some other answer. That night he found that a change had come over his ring. Now all evidence that it resisted red encroachments was gone. His wedding band burned completely crimson under the dominion of the moon, flaming coldly on his hand as if in greedy response to Drool's power. The next morning, he began the day's riding like a man torn between opposing poles of insanity. But there was a foretaste of summer in the noon breeze. The air turned warm and redolent with the ripeness of the earth. The flowers had a confident bloom, and the birds sang languidly. Gradually, Covenant grew full of lassitude. Languor loosened the strings of his will. Only the habit of riding kept him on Dura's back. He became numb to such superficial considerations. He hardly noticed when the river began to curve northward away from the company, or when the hills began to climb higher. He moved blankly on the warm currents of the day. That night he slept deeply, dreamlessly, and the next day he rode on in numbness and unconcern. Waking slumber held him. It was a wilderland that he wandered unaware. He was in danger without knowing it. Lassitude was the first step in an inexorable logic, the law of leprosy. The next was gangrene. A stink of rotting, live flesh so terrible that even some physicians could not bear it. A stench which ratified the outcasting of lepers in a way no mere compassion or unprejudice could oppose. But Covenant traveled his dream with his mind full of sleep. When he began to recover, early in the afternoon of the third day from Soaring Woodhelvin, the 18th since the company had left Revelstone, he found himself looking over Morin Moss Forest. The company stood on the last hilltop before the land fell under the dark aegis of the trees. Morin Moss lay at the foot of the hill like a lapping sea. Its edges gripped the hillsides as if the trees had clenched their roots in the slopes and refused to be driven back. The dark, various green of the forest spread to the horizon north and east and south. It had a forbidding look. It seemed to defy the quest to pass through it. High Lord Prothall stopped on the crest of the hill and gazed for a long time over the forest, weighing the time needed to ride around Morin Moss against the obscure dangers of the trees. Finally, he dismounted. He looked over the riders, and his eyes were full of potential anger as he spoke. "We will rest now. Then we will ride into Morin Moss, and we'll not stop until we have reached the far side. A journey of nearly a day and a night. During that ride, we must show neither blade nor spark. Hear you, all swords sheathed, all arrows quivered, all knives cloaked, all spear tips bound, and every spark or gleam of fire quenched. I will have no mistake. Morin Moss is wilder than Grimmerdor, and none go unanxious into that wood. The trees have suffered for ages, and they do not forget their kinship with Garrotting Deep. Pray that they do not crush us all regardless. He paused, scanning the company until he was sure that all understood him. Then he added more gently, "It is possible that there is still a Forestal in Morin Moss, though that knowledge has been lost since the desecration." Several of the warriors tensed at the word Forestal, but Covenant, coming slowly out of his languor, felt none of the awe which seemed to be expected of him. He asked, as he had once before, "Do you worship trees?" "Worship?" Prothol seemed puzzled. "The word is obscure to me." Covenant stared. A moment later, the High Lord went on, "Do you ask if we reverence the forests?" "Of course. They are alive, and there is earth power in all living things, all stone and earth and water and wood. Surely you understand that we are the servants of that power. We care for the life of the land." He glanced back at the forest, then continued, "The earth power takes many forms between wood and stone. Stone bedrocks the world, and to the best of our comprehension, weak as it is, that form of power does not know itself. But wood is otherwise. At one time, in the dimmest, lost distance of the past, nearly all the land was one forest. One mighty wood from Trothgard and Melancurian Skyweir to Serengrave Flat and Seaweech. And the forest was awake. It knew and welcomed the new life which people brought to the land. It felt the pain when mere men, blind, foolish moments in the ancientness of the land, cut down and burned out the trees to make space in which to breed their folly. Ah, it is hard to take pride in human history. Before the slow knowledge spread throughout the forest, so that each tree knew its peril, hundreds of leagues of life had been decimated. By our reckoning, the deed took time, more than 1,000 years. But it must have seemed a rapid murder to the trees. At the end of that time, there were only 4 places left in the land where the soul of the forest lingered, survived, and shuddered in its awesome pain, and took resolve to defend itself. Then for many ages, Giant Woods and Grimmerdor and Morin Moss and Garrotting Deep lived, and their awareness endured in the care of the Forestals. They remembered, and no human or vile or cave-wight who dared enter them survived. Now, even those ages are past. We know not if the Forestals yet live, though only a fool would deny that Coroil Wildwood still walks in Garrotting Deep. But the awareness which enabled the trees to strike back is fading. The lords have defended the forests since Beric Halfhand first took up the Staff of Law. We have not let the trees diminish. Yet their spirit fails. Cut off from each other, the collective knowledge of the forests dies, and the glory of the world becomes less than it was. Prothol paused sadly for a moment before concluding, "It is in deference to the remaining spirit, and in reverence for the earth power, that we ask permission for so many to enter the forest at one time. And it is in simple caution that we offer no offense. The spirit is not dead, and the power of Morin Moss could crush 1,000,000 men if the trees were pained into wakefulness." "Are there other dangers?" Quan asked. "Will we need our weapons?" "No. Lord Fowl's servants have done great harm to the forests in ages past. Perhaps Grimmerdor has lost its power, but Morinmas remembers. And tonight is the dark of the moon. Even Druul Rockworm is not mad enough to order his forces into Morinmas at such a time. And the Despiser has never been such a fool. Quietly the riders dismounted. Some of the yeomen fed the horses, while others prepared a quick meal. Soon all the company except Covenant had eaten. And after the meal, while the Bloodguard watched, the questers laid themselves down to rest before the long passage of the forest. When they were roused again and ready to travel, Prothol strode up to the edge of the hill crest. The breeze was stronger there. It fluttered his black-sashed blue robe as he raised his staff and cried loudly, "Hail, Morinmas! Forest of the One Forest! Enemy of our enemies! Morinmas, hail!" His voice fell into the expanse of the woods forlornly, without echo. "We are the lords, foes to your enemies, and learners of the Lilianril lore. We must pass through. Hearken, Morinmas. We hate the axe and flame which hurt you. Your enemies are our enemies. Never have we brought edge of axe or flame of fire to touch you, nor ever shall. Morinmas, hearken. Let us pass." His call disappeared into the depths of the forest. At last he lowered his arms, then turned and came back to the company. He mounted his horse, looked once more sternly over the riders. At his signal, they rode down toward the knuckled edges of Morinmas. They seemed to fall like a stone into the forest. One moment they were still winding down the hillside above the trees. The next they had penetrated the gloomy deep, and the sunlight closed behind them like an unregainable door. Birinair went at the head of the company, with his higher brand's staff held across his mount's neck. And behind him rode first Mark Tuvor on the Ranahin stallion Marni, for the Ranahin had nothing to fear from the old anger of Morinmas, and Marni could guide Birinair if the aged heartthrall went astray. Behind Tuvor came Prothol and Morum, with Laura at Morum's back, and behind them came Covenant and Foamfollower. The giant still carried the sleeping child. Then followed Quan and his yeomen, bunched together among the Bloodguard. There was room for them to pass. The trees with their dark mingled ebony and russet trunks were widely placed, leaving space between them for undergrowth and animals, and the riders found their way without difficulty. But the trees were not tall. They rose for 15 or 20 feet on squat trunks, then spread outward in gnarled, drooping branches heavy with foliage, so that the company was completely enshrouded in the gloom of Morinmas. The branches interwove until each tree seemed to be standing with its arms braced heavily on the shoulders of its kindred, and from the limbs hung great curtains and strands of moss, dark, thick, damp moss falling from the branches like slow blood caught and frozen as it bled. The moss dangled before the riders as if it were trying to turn them aside, deflect them from their path, and on the deep mossy ground the hooves of the horses made no sound. The riders went their way as silently as if they had been translated into an illusion. Instinctively dodging away from the dark touch of the moss, Covenant peered into the forest's perpetual gloaming. As far as he could see in all directions, he was surrounded by the grotesque ire of moss and branch and trunk. But beyond the limit of his explicit senses, he could see more, see and smell, and in the silence of the forest, hear the brooding heart of the woods. There the trees contemplated their grim memories, the broad, budding burst of self-awareness, when the spirit of the wood lay grandly over hundreds of leagues of rich earth, and the raw plummet of pain and horror and disbelief spreading like ripples on an ocean until the farthest leaves in the land shivered when the slaughter of the trees began, root and branch and all cut and consumed by axe and flame and stumps dragged away. And the scurry and anguish of the animals, slaughtered too, or bereft of home and health and hope, and the clear song of the forest owl, whose tune taught the secret angry pleasure of crushing, of striking back at tiny men and tasting their blood at the roots, and the slow weakness which ended even that last fierce joy, and left the trees with nothing but their stiff memories and their despair as they watched their rage fall into slumber. Covenant sensed that the trees knew nothing of lords or friendship. The lords were too recent in the land to be remembered. No, it was weakness, the failure of spirit that let the riders pass. Weakness, sorrow, helpless sleep. Here and there he could hear trees that were still awake and aching for blood, but they were too few, too few. Morin Moss could only brood, bereft of force by its own ancient mortality. A hand of moss struck him and left moisture on his face. He wiped the wet away as if it were acid. Then the sun set beyond Morin Moss, and even that low light was gone. Covenant leaned forward in his saddle, alert now, and afraid that Birinair would lose his way or stumble into a curtain of moss and be smothered. But as darkness seeped into the air as if it were dripping from the enshrouding branches, a change came over the wood. Gradually, a silver glow grew on the trunks, grew and strengthened as night filled the forest, until each tree stood shimmering like a lost soul in the gloom. The silver light was bright enough to show the riders their way. Across the shifting patterns of the glow, the moss sheets hung like shadows of an abyss, black holes into emptiness, giving the wood a blotched, leprous look. But the company huddled together and rode on through a night illumined only by the gleam of the trees and by the red burn of Covenant's ring. He felt that he could hear the trees muttering in horror at the offense of his wedding band, and its pulsing red glow appalled him. Moss fingers flicked his face with a wet, probing touch. He clenched his hands over his heart, trying to pull himself inward, reduce himself, and pass unnoticed. Rode as if he carried an axe under his robe, and was terrified lest the trees discover it. That long ride passed like the hurt of a wound. Acute throbs finally blurred together, and at last the company was again riding through the dimness of day. Covenant shivered, looked about within himself. What he saw left him mute. He felt that the cistern of his rage was full of darkness, but he was caught in toils of insoluble circumstance. The darkness was a cup which he could neither drink nor dash aside, and he was trembling with hunger. He could hardly restrain himself from striking back at the damp clutch of the moss. Still, the company traveled the perpetual twilight of Morin Moss. They were silent, stifled by the enshrouding branches, and in the cloying quiet, Covenant felt as lost as if he had missed his way in the old forest which had covered all the land. With vague fury, he ducked and dodged the grasping of the moss. Time passed, and he had a mounting desire to scream. Then finally, Birinair waved his staff over his head and gave a weak shout. The horses understood. They stumbled into a tired run beside the strong step of the Ranahin. For a moment the trees seemed to stand back, as if drawing away from the company's madness. Then the riders broke out into sunshine. They found themselves under a noon sky on a slope which bent gradually down to a river lying squarely across their way. Birinair and Marni had brought them unerringly to Rome's Edge Ford. Hoarsely shouting their relief, the warriors set heels to their mounts, and the company swept down the slope at a brave gallop. Shortly, the horses splashed into the stream, showering themselves and their glad riders with the cool spray of the Rome's edge. On the southern bank, Prothol called a halt. The passage of Morinmos was over. Once halted, the company tasted the toll of the passage. Their foodless vigil had weakened the riders, but the horses were in worse condition. They quivered with exhaustion. Once their last run was over, their necks and backs sagged. They scarcely had the strength to eat or drink. Despite the nickering encouragement of the Ranahan, two of the yeoman mustangs collapsed on their sides on the grass, and the others stood around with unsteady knees like foals. "Rest, rest," Prothol said in roomy anxiety. "We go no farther this day." He walked among the horses, touching them with his old hands and humming a strengthening song. Only the Ranahan and the Bloodguard were unmarred by fatigue. Foam Follower lowered the child Pietan into Laura's arms, then dropped himself wearily on his back on the stiff grass. Since the company had left Soaring Woodhelven, he had been unnaturally silent. He had avoided speaking as if he feared his voice would betray him. Now he appeared to feel the strain of traveling without the support of stories and laughter. Covenant wondered if he would ever hear the giant laugh again. Sourly, he reached a hand up to get his staff from Dura's saddle and noticed for the first time what Morinmos had done to his white robe. It was spattered and latticed with dark green stains, the markings of the moss. The stains offended him. With a scowl, he looked around the company. The other riders must have been more adept at dodging. They showed none of the green signature of the moss. Lord Morham was the only exception. Each shoulder of his robe bore a dark stripe like an insignia. Roughly, Covenant rubbed at the green, but it was dry and set. Darkness murmured in his ears like the distant rumor of an avalanche. His shoulders hunched like a strangler's. He turned away from the questers, stamped back into the river. Nodding his fingers in his robe, he tried to scrub out the stains of the forest. But the marks had become part of the fabric, immitigable. They clung to his robe, signing it like a chart, a map to unknown regions. In a fit of frustration, he pounded the river with his fists, but its current erased his ripples as if they had never existed. He stood erect and dripping in the stream. His heart labored in his chest. For a moment, he felt that his rage must either overflow or crack him to the bottom. "None of this is happening." His jaw quivered. "I can't stand it." Then he heard a low cry of surprise from the company. An instant later, Morham commanded quietly, "Covenant, come." Spitting protests against so many things that he could not name them all, he turned around. The questers were all facing away from him, their attention bent on something which he could not see because of the water in his eyes. Morham repeated, "Come." Covenant wiped his eyes, waded to the bank, and climbed out of the river. He made his dripping way through the yeomen until he reached Morham and Prothol. Before them stood a strange woman. She was slim and slight, no taller than Covenant's shoulder, and dressed in a deep brown shift which left her legs and arms free. Her skin was sun-darkened to the color of earth. Her long black hair she wore tied into one strand by a heavy cord. The effect was severe, but this was relieved by a small necklace of yellow flowers. Despite her size, she stood proudly, with her arms folded and her legs slightly apart, as if she could deny the company entrance to the plains of Ra if she chose. She watched Covenant's approach as if she had been waiting for him. When he stopped, joining Morham and Prothol, she raised her hand and gave him the salute of welcome awkwardly, as if it were not a natural gesture for her. "Hail, Ringthane," she said in a clear, nickering voice. "White gold is known. We homage and serve. Be welcome." He shook the water from his forehead and stared at her. After greeting him, she turned with a ritual precision toward each of the others. "Hail, High Lord Prothol. Hail, Lord Morham. Hail, Saltheart Foam Follower. Hail, First Mark Tuvor. Hail Warhaft Quan. In turn, they saluted her gravely, as if they recognized her as a potentate. Then she said, I am Main Thrall Lithe. We see you. Speak. The plains of Ra are not open to all. Prothol stepped forward. Raising his staff, he held it in both hands level with his forehead and bowed deeply. At this, the woman smiled faintly. Holding her own palms beside her head, she matched his bow. This time, her movement was smooth, natural. You know us, she said. You come from afar, but you are not unknowing. Prothol replied, We know that the Main Thralls are the first tenders of the Ranahin. Among the Ramen, you are most honored, and you know us. He stood close to her now, and the slight stoop of his agedness inclined him over her. Her brown skin and his blue robe accentuated each other like earth and sky, but still she withheld her welcome. No, she returned. Not no. You come from afar, unknown. Yet you speak our names. She shrugged. We are cautious. We have watched since you left Morinmos. We heard your talk. We? Covenant wondered blankly. Slowly her eyes moved over the company. We know the Sleepless Ones. The Blood Guard. She did not appear pleased to see them. They take the Ranahin into peril. But we serve. They are welcome. Then her gaze settled on the two collapsed horses and her nostrils flared. You have urgency? She demanded, but her tone said that she would accept few justifications for the condition of the Mustangs. At that, Covenant understood why she hesitated to welcome the lords, though they must have been known to her, at least by legend or reputation. She wanted no one who mistreated horses to enter the plains of Ra. The High Lord answered with authority, Yes, Fang Thane lives. Lithe faltered momentarily. When her eyes returned to Covenant, they swarmed with hints of distant fear. Fang Thane, she breathed. Enemy of Earth and Ranahin. Yes, White Gold knows. The Ring Thane is here. Abruptly, her tone became hard. To save the Ranahin from rending. She looked at Covenant as if demanding promises from him. He had none to give her. He stood angrily dripping, too soaked with hunger to respond in repudiation or acquiescence or shame. Soon she retreated in bafflement. To Prothol she said, Who is he? What manner of man? With an ambivalent smile, Prothol said, He is Lord Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and white gold wielder. He is a stranger to the land. Do not doubt him. He turned the battle for us when we were beset by the servants of Fang Thane. Cave whites and Urviles, and a griffin spawned in some unknown pit of malice. Lithe nodded noncommittally, as if she did not understand all his words. But then she said, There is urgency. No action against Fang Thane must be hindered or delayed. There have been other signs. Rending beasts have sought to cross into the plains. High Lord Prothol, be welcome in the plains of Ra. Come with all speed to Manholm. We must take counsel. Your welcome honors us, the High Lord responded. We return honor in accepting. We will reach Manholm the second day from today, if the horses live. His cautious speech made Lithe laugh lightly. You will rest in the hospitality of the Ramen before the sun sets a second time from this moment. We have not served the Ranahin knowledgeless from the beginning. Cords, up! Here is a test for your meaning. At once, four figures appeared, They suddenly stood up from the grass in a loose semicircle around the company as if they had risen out of the ground. The four, three men and a woman, were as slight as Mane Thrawlithe, and dressed like her in brown over their tanned skin. But they wore no flowers, and had short lengths of rope wrapped around their waists. "Come, Cords," said Lithe. "Stalk these riders no longer. You have heard me welcome them. Now tend their horses and their safety. They must reach Manhome before nightfall of the next day." The four Ramen stepped forward, and Lithe said to Prothol, "Here are my Cords, Thew, Hearn, Grace, and Rusta. They are hunters. While they learn the ways of the Runahin and the knowing of the Mane Thralls, they protect the plains from dangerous beasts. I have spent much time with them. They can care for your mounts." With courteous nods to the company, the Cords went straight to the horses and began examining them. "Now," Lithe continued, "I must depart. The word of your coming must cross the plains. The Windhomes must prepare for you. Follow Rusta. He is nearest to his maning. Hail, lords. We will eat together at nightfall of the new day." Without waiting for a reply, the Mane Thrall turned southward and sprinted away. She ran with surprising speed. In a few moments, she had crested a hill and vanished from sight. Watching her go, Morhem said to Covenant, "It is said that a Mane Thrall can run with the Runahin for a short time." Behind them, Cord Hearn muttered, "It is said, and it is true." Morhem faced the Cord. He stood as if waiting to speak. His appearance was much like Lithe's, though his hair had not been permitted to grow as long as hers, and his features had a dour cast. When he had Morhem's attention, he said, "There is a grass which will heal your horses. I must leave you to bring it." Gently, the Lord responded, "The knowing is yours. Do what is best." Hearn's eyes widened, as if he had not expected soft words from people who mistreated horses. Then, uncertain of his movements, he saluted Morhem in Lord's fashion. Morhem returned a Ramen bow. Hearn grinned and was about to gallop away when Covenant abruptly asked, "Why don't you ride? You've got all those Ranahin." Morhem moved swiftly to restrain Covenant, but the damage was already done. Hearn stared as if he had heard blasphemy, and his strong fingers twitched the rope from about his waist, holding it between his fists like a garrote.
"We do not ride."
"Have a care, Hearn," said Cord Rusta softly. "The Mane Thrall welcomed him." Hearn glared at his companion, then roughly re-knotted his rope around his waist. He spun away from the company and soon vanished as if he had disappeared into the earth. Gripping Covenant's arm, Morhem said sternly, "The Ramen serve the Runahin. That is their reason for life. Do not affront them, unbeliever. They are quick to anger, and the deadliest hunters in the land. There might be 100 of them within the range of my voice, and you would never know. If they chose to slay you, you would die ignorant." Covenant felt the force of the warning. It seemed to invest the surrounding grass with eyes that peered balefully. He felt conspicuous, as if his green mapped robe were a guide for deadly intentions hidden in the ground. He was trembling again. While Hearn was away, the rest of the Cords worked on the horses, caressing, cajoling them into taking water and food. Under their hands, most of the mustangs grew steadier. Satisfied that their mounts were in good hands, the Lords went to talk with Quan and Tuvor, and around them, the warriors began preparing food. Covenant cursed the aroma. He lay on the stiff grass and tried to still his gnawing emptiness by staring at the sky. Fatigue caught up with him, and he dozed for a while. But soon he was roused by a new smell which made his hunger sting in his guts. It came from clumps of rich, ferny flowers that the horses were munching, the healing herbs which Cord Hearn had brought for them. All the horses were on their feet now, and they seemed to gain strength visibly as they ate. The piquant odor of the flowers gave Covenant a momentary vision of himself on his hands and knees, chewing like the horses, and he muttered in suppressed savagery, "Damn, horses eat better than we do." Cord Rusta smiled oddly and said, "This grass is poison to humans. It is a manibovum, the flower of health and madness. Horses it heals, but men and women, they are not enough for it." Covenant answered with a glare and tried to stifle the groan of his hunger. He felt a perverse desire to taste the grass. It sang to his senses delectably. Yet the thought that he had been brought so low was bitter to him, and he savored its sourness instead of food. Certainly the plants worked wonders for the horses. Soon they were feeding and drinking normally, and looked sturdy enough to bear riders again. The questers finished their meal, then packed away their supplies. The cords pronounced the horses ready to travel. Shortly the riders were on their way south over the swift hills of Ra, with the Ramen trotting easily beside them. Under the hooves of the horses, the grasslands rolled and passed like mild billows, giving the company an impression of speed. They rode over the hardy grass up and down short, low slopes, along shallow valleys between copses and small woods beside thin streams, across broad flats. It was a rough land. Except for the faithful Aliantha, the terrain was unrefined by fruit trees or cultivation or any flowers other than a manibovum. But still the plains seemed full of elemental life, as if the low, quick hills were formed by the pulse of the soil, and the stiff grass were rich enough to feed anything strong enough to bear its nourishment. When the sun began to set, the bracken on the hillsides glowed purple. Herds of Nilgai came out of the woods to drink at the streams, and ravens flocked clamorously to the broad chintz trees which dotted the flats. But the riders gave most of their attention to the roaming Ranahin. Whether galloping by like triumphal banners or capering together in evening play, the great horses wore an aura of majesty, as if the very ground they thundered on were proud of their creation. They called in fierce joy to the bearers of the blood guard, and these chargers did little dances with their hooves, as if they could not restrain the exhilaration of their return home. Then the unmounted Ranahin dashed away, full of gay blood and unfetterable energy, whinnying as they ran. Their calls made the air tingle with vitality. Soon the sun set in the west, bidding farewell to the plains with a flare of orange. Covenant watched it go with dour satisfaction. He was tired of horses, tired of Ranahin and Ramen and Bloodguard and lords and quests, tired of the unrest of life. He wanted darkness and sleep, despite the blood burn of his ring, the new coming crescent of the moon, and the vulture wings of horror. But when the sun was gone, Rusta told Prothol that the company would have to keep on riding. There was danger, he said. Warnings had been left in the grass by other Ramen. The company would have to ride until they were safe, a few leagues more. So they traveled onward. Later the moon rose, and its defiled sliver turned the night to blood, calling up a lurid answer from Covenant's ring and his hungry soul. Then Rusta slowed the riders, warned them to silence. With as much stealth as they could muster, they angled up the south side of a hill and stopped just below its crest. The company dismounted, left a few of the blood guard to watch over the horses, and followed the cords to the hilltop. Low, flat ground lay to the north. The cords peered across it for some time, then pointed. Covenant fought the fatigue of his eyes and the crimson dimness until he thought he saw a dark patch moving southward over the flat. "Crash," whispered Hearn. "Yellow wolves. Fang Thane's brood. They have crossed Rome's edge." "Wait for us," Rusta breathed. "You will be safe." He and the other cords faded into the night. Instinctively, the company drew closer together and stared with throbbing eyes through the thin red light which seemed to ooze like sweat from the moving darkness on the flat. In suspense, they stood hushed, hardly breathing. Pieten sat in Laura's arms, as wide awake as a vigil. Covenant learned later that the pack numbered 15 of the great yellow wolves. Their four shoulders were waist high on a man. They had massive jaws lined with curved, ripping fangs and yellow, omnivorous eyes. They were drooling on the trail of two Ranahan foals, protected only by a stallion and his mare. The legends of the Ramen said that the breath of such kresh was hot enough to scorch the ground, and they left a wheel of pain across the grass wherever their plundering took them. But all Covenant saw now was an approaching darkness, growing larger moment by moment. Then to his uncertain eyes the rear of the pack appeared to swirl in confusion briefly, and as the wolves moved on he thought he could see two or three black dots lying motionless on the flat. The pack swirled again. This time several short howls of surprise and fear broke the silence. One harsh snarl was suddenly choked off. The next instant, the pack started a straight dash toward the company, leaving five more dots behind. But now, Covenant was sure that the dots were dead wolves. Three more kresh dropped. Now he could see three figures leap away from the dead and sprint after the survivors. They vanished into shadows at the foot of the hill. From the darkness came sounds of fighting, enraged snarls, the snap of jaws that missed their mark, bones cracking. Then silence flooded back into the night. The apprehension of the company sharpened, for they could see nothing. The shadow reached almost to the crest of the hill where they stood. Abruptly, they heard the sound of frantic running. It came directly toward them. Prothol sprang forward. He raised his staff, and blue fire flared from its tip. The sudden light revealed a lone kresh with hatred in its eyes, pelting at him. Tuvor reached Prothol's side an instant before Foam Follower, but the giant went ahead to meet the wolf's charge. Then, without warning, Cord Grace rose out of hiding squarely in front of the wolf. She executed her movement as smoothly as if she were dancing. As she stood, a swift jerk freed her rope. When the kresh sprang at her, she flipped a loop of the rope around its neck and stepped neatly aside, turning as she did so to brace her feet. The force of the wolf's charge as it hit her noose broke its neck. The yank pulled her from her feet, but she rolled lightly to one side, keeping pressure on the rope, and came to her feet in a position to finish the kresh if it were still alive. The yeoman met her performance with a low murmur of admiration. She glanced toward them and smiled diffidently in the blue light of Prothol's staff. Then she turned to greet the other cords as they loped out of the shadow of the hill. They were uninjured. All the wolves were dead. Lowering his staff, Prothol gave the cords a Ramen bow. "Well done," he said. They bowed in acknowledgement. When he extinguished his staff, red darkness returned to the hilltop. In the blood light, the riders began moving back to their horses. But Banner stepped over to the dead wolf and pulled Grace's rope from around its neck. Holding the cord in a fighting grip, he stretched it taut. "A good weapon," he said with his awkward inflectionlessness. "The Ramen did mighty work with it in the days when High Lord Kevin fought corruption openly." Something in his tone reminded Covenant that the Bloodguard were lusty men who had gone unwived for more than 2,000 years. Then, on the spur of an obscure impulse, Banner tightened his muscles and the rope snapped. Shrugging slightly, he dropped the pieces on the dead kresh. His movement had the finality of a prophecy. Without a glance at Cord Grace, he left the hilltop to mount the Ranahan that had chosen him. Chapter 19. Ring Thane's Choice. Cord Rusta informed Prothol that, according to Ramen custom, dead renders of the Ranahan were left for the vultures. The Ramen had no desire to honor kresh or to affront the earth by burying them, and pyres raised the danger of fire on the plains. So the riders could rest as soon as their horses were away from the smell of death. The cord led the company on southward for nearly a league until he was satisfied that no night breeze would carry unrest to the animals. Then the quest camped. Covenant slept fitfully, as if he lay with the point of a spike against his stomach, and when the dawn came, he felt as ineffectual as if he had spent the night trying to counterpunch hunger. And when his nose tasted again the tangy smell of the poison Amanibavum, the sensation made his eyes water as if he had been struck. He did not believe that he could hold himself upright much longer, but he still did not have the answer he needed. He had found no new insight, and the green handiwork of Morin Moss on his robe seemed illegible. A sure instinct told him that he could find what he lacked in the extremity of hunger. When his companions had eaten and were ready to travel again, he climbed dully onto Dura's back and rode with them. His eyes dripped senselessly from time to time, but he was not weeping. He felt charged with passion, but could not let it out. The grief of his leprosy did not permit any such release. In contrast to the cold ash of his mood, the day was cheery, full of bright, unclouded sun and a warm northward breeze, of deep sky and swift hills. Soon the rest of the company had surrendered to the spell of the plains, an incantation woven by the proud roaming of the Ronin. Time and again, mighty horses cantered or raced by, glancing aside at the riders with laughter in their eyes and keen, shimmering calls in their throats. The sight of them added a spring to the strides of the cords, and as the morning passed, Grace and Thu sang together, "Run, Ronin, gallop, play, feed and drink and coat gloss gleam. You are the marrow of the earth. No rein will curb or bit control. No claw or fang unpunished rend. No horse blood drop without the healing grass. We are the Ramen, born to serve. Main thrall curry, cord protect, win home hearth and bed anneal. Our feet do not bear our hearts away. Grass-grown hooves and forehead stars, hocks and withers, earth would bloom. Regal run in, gallop, run. We serve the tail of the sky, mane of the world." Hearing the song, Ronahin pranced around the company and away, running as smoothly as if the ground flowed in their strides. In Foam Follower's arms, Pieton stirred and shook off his day sleep for a while to watch the Ronahin with something like longing in his blank eyes. Prothol and Morum sat relaxed in their saddles, as if for the first time since leaving Revelstone they felt that the company was safe. And tears ran down Covenant's face as if it were a wall. In his emptiness, the heat of the sun confused him. His head seemed to be fulminating, and the sensation made him feel that he was perched on an unsteady height, where great gulfs of vertiginous grass snapped like wolves at his heels. But the clingor of his saddle held him on Dura's back. After a time, he dozed into a dream where he danced and wept and made love at the commands of a satirical puppeteer. When he awoke, it was mid-afternoon, and there were mountains across most of the horizon ahead. The company was making good time. In fact, the horses were cantering now, as if the plains gave them more energy than they could contain. For a moment, he looked ahead to Manholm, where, he foresaw, a misguided and valueless respect for his wedding ring would offer him to the Ronahin as a prospective rider. This was surely one of Prothol's reasons for choosing to visit the plains of Ra before approaching Mount Thunder. Honor the Urlord, the Ring Thane. Ah, hell. He tried to envision himself riding a Ronahin, but his imagination could not make the leap. More than anything else except Andalane, the great, dangerous, earth-powerful horses quintessenced the land. And Joan had been a breaker of horses. For some reason, the thought made his nose sting, and he tried to hold back his tears by gritting his teeth. The rest of the afternoon he passed by watching the mountains. They grew ahead of the company as if the peaks were slowly clambering to their feet. Curving away southwest and northeast, the range was not as high as the mountains behind Middle Stonedown, but it was rugged and raw, as if high pinnacles had been shattered to make those forbidding, impenetrable. Covenant did not know what lay behind the mountains, and did not want to know. Their impenetrability gave him an obscure comfort, as if they came between him and something he could not bear to see. They stood up more swiftly now as the company rode at a slow run toward them. The sun was dipping into the western plains as the riders entered the foothills of a precipitous outcropping of the range, and their backs were hued in orange and pink as they crossed a last rise and reached a broad, flat glade at the foot of the cliff. There, at last, was Manholm. The bottom of the cliff face for the last 250 or 300 feet inclined sharply inward along a broad, half-oval front, leaving a cave like a deep, vertical bowl in the rock. Far back in the cave, where they were protected from the weather and yet still exposed to the open air, were the hooped tents of the Raman families. And in the front, under the shelter of the cliff, was the communal area, the open space and fires where the Raman cooked and talked and danced and sang together when they were not out on the plains with the Run-In. The whole place seemed austere, as if generations of Raman had not worn a welcome for themselves in the stone. For Manholm was only a center, a beginning for the plains roaming of a nomadic people. Perhaps 70 Raman gathered to watch the company approach. They were nearly all Winholms, the young and old of the Raman, and others who needed safety and a secure bed. Unlike the cords and main thralls, they had no fighting ropes. But Lithe was there, and she walked lightly out to meet the company with three other Raman whom Covenant took to be main thralls also. They wore necklets of yellow flowers like hers and carried their cords in their hair rather than at their waists. The company halted, and Prothall dismounted before the main thralls. He bowed to them in the Raman fashion, and they gestured their welcome in return. "Hail again, lords from afar," said Lithe. "Hail, Ring Thane, and High Lord, and Giant, and Bloodguard. Be welcome to the hearth and bed of Manholm." At her salutation, the Winholms surged forward from under the cliff. As the riders got down from their horses, each was greeted by a smiling Winholm bearing a small band of woven flowers. With gestures of ritual stateliness, they fastened the bands to the right wrists of their guests. Covenant climbed off Dura and found a shy, bold Raman girl, no more than 15 or 16 years old, standing before him. She had fine black hair that draped her shoulders and soft, wide brown eyes. She did not smile. She seemed awed to find herself greeting the Ring Thane, the wielder of the white gold. Carefully, she reached out to put her flowers around his wrist. Their smell staggered him, and he nearly retched. The band was woven of a manibavum. Its tang burned his nose like acid, made him so hungry that he felt about to vomit chunks of emptiness. He was helpless to stop the tears that ran from his eyes. With a face full of solemnity, the Winholm girl raised her hands and touched his tears as if they were precious. Behind him, the Run-In of the Blood Guard were galloping off into the freedom of the plains. The cords were leading the company's horses away to be tended, and more Raman cantered into the glade in answer to the news of the quest's arrival. But Covenant kept his eyes on the girl, stared at her as if she were a kind of food. Finally she answered his gaze by saying, "I am Winholm Gay. Soon I will share enough knowing to join the cords." After an instant of hesitation, she added, "I am to care for you while you guest here." When he did not respond, she said hurriedly, "Others will gladly serve if my welcome is not accepted." Covenant remained silent for a moment longer, clenching his useless ferocity. But then he gathered his strength for one final refusal. "I don't need anything. Don't touch me." The words hurt his throat. A hand touched his shoulder. He glanced around to find Foam Follower beside him. The giant was looking down at Covenant, but he spoke to the pain of rejection in Gay's face. "Do not be sad, little Winholm," he murmured. "Covenant Ring Thane tests us. He does not speak his heart. Gay smiled gratefully up at Foam Follower, then said with sudden sauciness, "Not so little, giant. Your size deceives you. I have almost reached courting." Her jibe appeared to take a moment to penetrate Foam Follower. Then his stiff beard twitched. Abruptly, he began to laugh. His glee mounted. It echoed off the cliff above Manhome until the mountains seemed to share his elation, and the infectious sound spread until everyone near him was laughing without knowing why. For a long moment, he threw out gales as if he were blowing debris from his soul. But Covenant turned away, unable to bear the loud weight of the giant's humor. "Hellfire," he growled. "Hell and blood. What are you doing to me?" He had made no decision, and now his capacity for self-denial seemed spent. So when Gay offered to guide him to his seat for the feast which the Winhomes had prepared, he followed her numbly. She took him under the ponderous overhang of the cliff to a central, clear space with a campfire burning in the middle. Most of the company had already entered Manhome. There were two other fires, and the Ramen divided the company into three groups. The Blood Guard sat around one of the fires, Quan and his 14 warriors around another, and in the center, the Ramen invited Prothol, Morum, Foam Follower, Laura, Pieton, and Covenant to join the main thralls. Covenant let himself be steered until he was sitting cross-legged on the smooth stone floor across the circle from Prothol, Morum, and Foam Follower. Four main thralls made places for themselves beside the lords, and Lythe seated herself near Covenant. The rest of the circle was filled with cords who had come in from the plains with their main thrall teachers. Most of the Winhomes bustled around cooking fires farther back in the cave, but one stood behind each guest, waiting to serve. Gay attended Covenant, and she hummed a light melody which reminded him of another song he had once heard. "Something there is in beauty, which grows in the soul of the beholder like a flower." Under the wood smoke and the cooking odors, he thought that he could smell Gay's clean, grassy fragrance. As he sat lumpishly on the stone, the last glow of the sunset waved orange and gold on the roof like an affectionate farewell. Then the sun was gone. Night spread over the plains. Campfire flames gave the only light in Manhome. The air was full of bustle and low talk, like a hill breeze rich in Ranahin scent. But the food Covenant dreaded did not come immediately. First, some of the chords danced. Three of them performed within the circle where Covenant sat. They danced around the fire with high, prancing movements and sang a nickering song to the beat of complex clapping from the Winhomes. The smooth flow of their limbs, the sudden eruptions of the dance, the dark tan of their skins made them look as if they were enacting the pulse of the plains, dancing the pulse by making it fast enough for human eyes to see. And they repeatedly bent their bodies so that the firelight cast horse-like shadows on the walls and ceiling. Occasionally, the dancers leaped close enough to Covenant for him to hear their song. Grass-grown hooves and forehead stars, hocks and withers, earthwood bloom, regal run-in, gallop, run. We serve the tail of the sky, mane of the world. The words and the dance made him feel that they expressed some secret knowledge, some vision that he needed to share. The feeling repelled him. He tore his eyes away from the dancers to the glowing coals of the fire. When the dance was done, he went on staring into the fire's heart with a gaze full of vague trepidations. Then the Winhomes brought food and drink to the circles. Using broad leaves for plates, they piled stew and wild potatoes before their guests. The meal was savory with rare herbs which the Ramen relished in their cooking, and soon the questers were deep in the feast. For a long time, the only sounds in Manhome were those of serving and eating. In the midst of the feast, Covenant sat like a stunted tree. He did not respond to anything Gay offered him. He stared at the fire. There was one coal in it which burned redly, like the night glow of his ring. He was doing a kind of VSE in his mind, studying his extremities from end to end, and his heart ached in the conviction that he was about to find some utterly unexpected spot of leprosy. He looked as if he were withering. After a time, people began to talk again. Prothol and Morum handed their leaf plates back to the Winholms and turned their attention to the main thralls.